Welcome to a new installment of RZ. We got to make it bi-weekly. My wife says we need a new name. Anyway, welcome to our podcast. Our podcast about religious Zionism, modern Orthodox, and everything in between. That was our tagline, wasn't it? We're just getting back into the swing of things.
Yeah.
Those are the dulcet tones of Rav Johnny Solomon. How's it going, Rav Johnny?
It's great. It's nice and warm outside. Anybody who is in a cooler country, come and visit Israel.
Mm-hmm. And, we have air conditioning
ice cream's meant. We have air conditioner here too. Yes.
Yes.
Hello. I am good, Baruch Hashem.
Okay, great. Let's jump into our topic. It is Aliyah season, Baruch Hashem. It's no secret that we at RZ Weekly, or Chodshi, I don't remember anymore. We at the RZ team are very pro Aliyah. Right? That need not be said. We're not going to be in your face about it, but this is an Aliyah discussion. It's time of Aliyah. We were actually quite moved by a beautiful post by Rabbi Larry Rothwax, who is making Aliyah. Yeah, I am in the field of education. I have heard at least 20 mechanchim, people in chinuch today, are making Aliyah, which is a different topic, which Johnny and Ali, we should talk about on another day. But Baruch Hashem, and we wish all of those people much hatzlacha. So we thought it would be good to talk about it specifically from our vantage point, our perspective, which is the idea of Aliyah to religious Zionist communities, meaning like we are religious Zionist people. So I think I have the perception that there's a lot of lack of understanding or appreciation or recognition of some of the strengths of religious Zionist communities and maybe some of the challenges of making Aliyah to a specifically religious Zionist community. So we want to put something out there. We want to put it out there. It's a topic that we feel should be discussed. Each of us, all of us. I live in Yad Binyamin. Mali lives in Alon Shvut.
Alon Shvut.
Johnny's in.
I'm in Eben Shmuel.
So all of those Yishuvim are interesting. They're different, but they have a lot of similarities. In that each one, John, I know if Yad Binyamin does have a sizable Anglo population. Mali, I've heard there are some Anglos in Alon Shvut. Do you have any?
There are a few Anglos.
Johnny, what about?
A small population. A significant minority.
Okay, so we're going to go around and then we're going to respond to one another. I'm going to throw it to Mali first. Mali, what would you say if someone's considering Aliyah and is making a choice or making a decision about, wait a second, do I want to go to a Ramat Beit Shemesh or to a Modi'in, or do I want to go to somewhere that's a little bit deeper in, that's really identified as religious Zionist? What would be the factors, what would you say that you're thinking about when it comes to thinking about the topic of Aliyah?
Okay, so first of all, I want to say, some of our pre-discussion, I want to leave on the table the question of, the pressure to make Aliyah, the not pressure to make Aliyah. I feel like it's an individual decision. We're not talking about that today, but I do want to say that I think, at least that's my perspective. I think that's yours also, both of yours also. Maybe it's not, maybe I'm only speaking for myself, but it's important to say that.
I'll just say, I feel that all of our listeners, wherever they are, either have made Aliyah or at least contemplated seriously. So I don't think they need our pressure.
I'm just saying,
I take them as serious people. Okay. They don't need to hear from me, oh, you should make Aliyah.
No, but I'm saying I have a lot of respect for the pushback against the make Aliyah. I think people should have the autonomy to make whatever life decision is right for them. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is I don't really want to address, where should you go deep into, over the Shtachim line? That's not really sort of what I want to talk about. I want to talk about this larger question of living within the religious Zionist world. I do think you're right that there are nuances about living, where you live will affect how much you're part of the Israeli religious Zionist world. And as Johnny reminds us frequently, there are many religious Zionisms, which is part of my point. But that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what it means that you'll essentially, like, not just that we'll be living in a religious Zionist world, but you'll be raising your children in that world. And I want to talk about some of the positives of that, and some of what that experience is. Because to me, I think that's one of the most meaningful parts of making Aliyah. It's also interesting because I just was on, just like, you know, scrolling Twitter, and some random person said, like, people who made Aliyah, what's good and what's bad? And the amount of people who said, like, good is that I'm raising my children here. This is a great place for kids. So I want to frame it sort of from that place. What I want to really say is that there's something that I think is not off. I mean, let me put it this way. I think often there's a sort of narrow perspective of what religious Zionism is in the when it's sort of portrayed in the diaspora. Sometimes it gets this sort of like bum rap as like it's very narrow and it's very, you know, sort of like you know, that it's like a one-trick pony. It's all about land, and it's all about, you know, and it's like a very isolated community. And I want to say that to me, one of the strongest parts about the religious Zionist world is that I absolutely think that is a completely upside-down picture of what religious Zionism is. I think that that what we're seeing happening in Israel is that the religious Zionist community actually is one of its most distinguishing characteristics is the degree to which it raises its children to care about and to be involved in the larger larger society, and not because they want to convert them all to become exactly like them. Dafka not. Dafka because there's I would say a mandate in our children of giving and of collective responsibility for Am Yisrael that I think is incredibly powerful. And I think that, to me, that's one of the biggest benefits of Aliyah, is that your children will feel a sense of mission and purpose. It's not always easy. It's not comfortable. It's not about comfort, but it's about meaning. And I think meaning is really, at the end of the day, what drives life satisfaction. And I'm sort of abstract here, so let me just bring it down to like a more concrete level. If your children are in the religious Zionist world, they will probably go to a religious. They will go to Bnei Akiva. They will go to Ariel. They will go to Ezra, or even not. They'll have, you know, volunteering in school. But I know that you do that in America also. But the degree
that's not always true. I think that's not obvious at all. Like,
that's my experience.
Start with youth groups. They're like, maybe some kids had Bnei Akiva. A lot of kids don't. And especially if you get more yeshivish,
then maybe that
there isn't
Bnei Akiva. No, I said religious Zionist, right?
People listening might not participate in Bnei Akiva in America. They might not send their kids to Camp Stone.
Like in America, you're probably going to have a volunteering, you know, obligation in high school. And, you know, even, I don't mean to be cynical, resume.
I'm talking about Tnuot Noar, the youth groups. Like, when I came here, I knew there was this idea of Tnuot Noar. Any concept of the all-encompassing nature of these
youth movements
for our kids. Right.
That's my point. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying if you come here, and your child is part of a Tnuot Noar, which is really sort of important, because if you want them to socialize appropriately in the community, they probably should be part of some Tnuot Noar. And if they aren't, find a different way. But that's the heart of socialization in this country, or in the religious Zionist world. And what I'm saying is there are a lot of benefits of Tnuot Noar. Really, I think there are, from a developmental perspective. Like the age of high school, it's all about peers. There's a lot of benefits. But what I want to focus on now is the sense of obligation that our youth have to give, and again, there's also shlichut. I'm not denying that they also feel like they have to, like, you know, settle the land, and I'm not saying that stuff isn't there, but there's so much that's about caring about the rest of the nation here in Am Yisrael, and it's becomes hardwired into their DNA to a degree where, like, religious Zionist kids. Like, you can't do Sherut Lumi for less than a year at this point. It used to be a year of Sherut. At this point, like, most of the girls are like, no, it has to be at least 2 years, right? Because I can't give less than that. A lot of girls, since October 7th especially, a tremendous movement from girls doing Sheirut to girls doing the army. Some of that, a lot of that is driven from everybody's going out and serving. I have to serve. How can I not serve? So there's this sense of giving that's installed into our students. And I want to give us one more example of that. My two sons and son-in-law's yeshiva, Rav Shaul, Rav Tamir, who we've quoted a lot, Rav Tamir's Granot. Rav Shaul is in Drom Tel Aviv, which is an it's a low socioeconomic area. It's a weaker population. They went there on purpose because they said part of our mission, part of our mandate, we can't just learn Torah. We have to also be giving to the community. And again, my Dati Lumi world, there is, and again, I don't want to get too complicated, but there is like a more, what's called the Kav line, which are, it's like a, I don't know how to describe it, but it's a less centrist Dati Lumi. It's a more Chardali, Charidi Lumi. There you might even argue, no, it's only because they want everybody to become like them. No, that's not what's happening in my Dati Lumi world. It's not about making other people religious or making them like them or converting them to their ideology. It's purely giving, purely giving. And we see this also with our soldiers who are going for Miluim after Miluim after Miluim. And when you say to them, and by the way, it's not just in the Haredi world that doesn't happen. And again, I'm not getting into a conversation about, you know, there are all these recent conversations about which population in Tel Aviv, and do they give and do they don't. Anecdotally, I think it is true that the disproportionately the Miluimnikim come from the Dati world. And when you ask them why, and they're kores tachat ha'ol, literally like, I think my son is going on 400 days of Miluim at this point. Wow. I think that's right. And when you say to them, you know, like, say no, he's like, but someone has to do it. Someone has to do it. I can't not. And so I think that spirit of giving and that spirit of responsibility to Am Yisrael, to the nation, is so powerful that I just felt the need to describe it because it's something that I find so moving. And I want to end with one last thing, which I thought was interesting. That's my husband told me this morning. He had this conversation with my son, who's now, you know, sort of moving into his age of like his peers are in professional jobs. And he said, you know what's interesting? He said, all of the public, all the sectoral jobs that are giving in some way, and I don't just mean, you know, social workers and, you know, teachers, judges and healthcare and a political aides, not to be a politician and to succeed, but all those public sector jobs, he said, it's all Dati Lumi people because their mindset isn't just, I want to get a job because I want to make money. Their mindset is, by definition, I live in this country and I want to do something meaningful to give back to my people. And it's on all levels, and I find it so moving. And again, why do I think this is like a positive for your children if they make Aliyah? Because at the end of the day, the biggest gift you can give somebody is a sense of meaning and purpose. And A, you're also going to be creating, like our kids, you're going to be creating incredible people. That's one thing. And also you're going to be creating people who feel maybe not comfortable, but deep, deep, deep meaning, which ultimately, I think, leads to joy.
Okay. And so Molly says her number one thing comes to mind of religious Zionist Aliyah is giving your kids a sense of meaning and purpose and connection to Am Yisrael in their lives. Thank you very much. Rav Johnny, where would you go?
So I echo all the things that have been said. They very much resonate with me, and I see these on a regular basis. You know, there's a very interesting dissonance in the religious Zionist communities in which we live. We know each other's community to a certain measure. By the way, I did a bit of research. As it happens, my community, which is smaller by both of yours, actually was established a little bit earlier than both of yours. It was in 1956, and it was established as an educational center. Alon Shvut, education really sits at the heartbeat of Alon Shvut, and the same thing with Yad Binyamin. You know, many towns and cities, the people come and then you build a school. Often when it comes to religious Zionist communities, you have an ideological educational vision, and then you bring the people. Meaning, it starts with the Hashkafa, even before you have the residents coming. And while outside of the religious world, there are questions raised about, you know, what is Zionism today? that sense of being a pioneer, of doing new things, of being driven by trying to build new communities, is alive and kicking in the religious Zionist communities and the religious Zionist world. There really is a thirst for growing communities, for growing families, and for growing ideas for the betterment of not just religious Zionist communities, but also the world at large. But I was going back to this word I said about dissonance, because religious Zionist communities don't operate generally with a figurehead telling everybody what to do. There's a strong emphasis on autonomy, right? People do what they do, especially where I live. It's kind of live and let live. It's unlike a meal where people tell you what you're supposed to eat. It's a bit like a buffet. People do whatever they want to do. Whoever turns up to different things, it's up to them. There is no rod. There is no person pointing a finger. There's no person standing at the top of the, you know, mountain directing how it should be. There's no Rebbe at the top of our table telling us what to do or who to vote for, per se. There's a big emphasis on autonomy in religious guidance communities that I have lived in and I know. And yet at the same time, you may well say that was going to create individualism, a focus on the self, on just the I. It's all about me. And yet, ironically, despite the strong emphasis on autonomy, there's a profound commitment to that collective spirit, that collective commitment. In fact, something that you both don't know, you're talking about South Tel Aviv. Well, you know that my daughter's getting married in less than a month. She and her husband are moving to South Tel Aviv. He's learning yeshiva in South Tel Aviv. That's where they're going. They're going to be part of a small garin trying to do good for the wider communities. And over Shabbat, I was speaking with a dear friend who's involved in Garinim Toanim in the north of Israel and elsewhere, helping hundreds of people move to Kiryat Shmona and things like that, trying to help rebuild this country after all that Kiryat Shmona and other places have suffered. And when you hear those stories, it just so moves your heart, because you know that that Zionistic spirit of being a pioneer is continuing to be expressed by the good deeds and good works, the actions, not just the rhetoric, not just the speeches, but the actions of younger people and older people. And so I find the religious Zionist communities fascinating, where you have this, on the one side, a big emphasis on autonomy, people doing different things in their own ways, which has strengths and weaknesses. And yet at the same time, there's almost an understanding that we may move in our own different ways, but when it comes to the big things, when it comes to national concerns, we may not vote the same way, but we generally feel the same way about most of the big things. We care deeply about the Jewish people, deeply about the Jewish country, deeply about the freedoms we've worked hard to achieve that our sons and our neighbors have fallen in defense of. And so there is this real beauty about that reverence for and love for the Jewish nation, the Jewish land, and of course, the Torah, which is our mandate to lead us to where we are, which is why we're here in Israel.
Oh, that's it? Okay, I'm going to pick up on that.
I thought so. Yeah, I thought I'd pause there.
That's beautiful.
Okay, it was beautiful. I want to pick up on something that Molly talked about. So first of all, just to add to what she said about the youth groups, it's not just that the kids participate in youth groups for socialization. When we first got here, we were shocked. We were like, okay, who are the adults in the room? Right? They're going on a two-day hike. Okay, so who's in charge? The 11th graders. Right? And when I came from America, we thought you can't do that. Like, who's in charge? And they're given a sense of, for better or for worse, autonomy, responsibility, freedom of movement, and expectations at a very young age. And kids like that, and they grab onto it. Sometimes, if you ask me personally as a parent, maybe a little too much, but I still have that little American in me. What can you do? I also I want to reflect also on the experience of the army as a parent. I think my perception is, and it was definitely a perception for me before making Aliyah, it's quite frightening to imagine that I'm going to bring my children to Israel and then expect my sons, at least, if not also my daughters, to serve in the army, which is it is frightening, to be honest with you. You know, let's not kid ourselves. And we in our community live with this reality in a way that's almost impossible to overstate. You know, it was just at a wedding on Sunday night. There is not a wedding. Like the chatan, before they started, had to mention his good friend Moshe Yitzchak Katz from Connecticut, a lone soldier who fell in Lebanon. And before you start the chuppah, you're just crying because you don't need to remember the Chorban because the Chorban is in front of us. And now many of the
chuppah. And the chatan is often going into Lebanon straight.
Yeah, the chatan. There's no shever bracha tonight because the chatan got called back to the army. You know, at every single wedding, there are always soldiers who are coming in uniform because they got a shichrur in order to come just for the and it's so moving. It's just so emotional. I find it very, very emotional. But obviously, at the same time, there's that sense of incredible pride, you know, that our sons could. So a lot of them didn't have to go into Krav units, but they chose it. That's their ethic. It's their ethos that they want to defend and protect Am Yisrael, and they do it from a sense of happiness and responsibility. It's their social culture. But I also see, I think people don't understand, and I didn't see it until I was a parent, to what degree army service, especially for the boys, especially the ones who go into combat training, to what degree it pushes them beyond their boundaries and teaches them how much they can accomplish. It really does, you know, and nothing in life will push you to do that. Nothing like serving in the army. Nothing will teach you to work as a team, to have literal brothers, to have comrades. We don't have that. I personally don't have that experience. I didn't serve. I didn't feel the need to like go into the rabbinate afterwards. I just didn't want to do that. But it's a life forming experience, and you just see it and you know it, and the way they talk to their friends and the experience that they have. Please God, they should be well, and they should protect, you know, all of our children. But I think that that's not something to be taken for granted, right? As opposed to seeing army service as a burden and it's something that to be scared of, we don't understand to what degree it builds up our children from a personal perspective. It builds them up from a spiritual perspective. And there's also dangers, of course. I'm not denying any of those things. But it's something I think that people sometimes don't understand and don't consider. You know, now we see it also, you know, I guess people in Chassaritz also, the many, many, many communities have children who have now served and have gone back to college. So that's a positive thing as well. But I think the idea of, I don't want to come to Israel because I don't want to send my kids to the army, I happen to think it's the other way around. It's a schut to send your children to the army. And not only that, they'll be better people for it. They'll become better adults. They'll be more responsible people, and they'll be ready to. They'll be much more ready to handle the trials and tribulations of adulthood. That's my spiel about religious Zionism. I'm not getting into obviously the complexities of the army and the hezder and could it be learning more and all of that. But I just think sometimes, you know, from afar, from the outside, right, you don't see that as a positive. It's only a negative. And of course, I'm not going to deny there are negatives. Like there are real, real challenges and fears of sending your children to the army. But I think sometimes you don't see the positives as well. Okay.
Can I just, I just want to jump in for that. Just last Shabbat, my community did a small kiddush for the Bogrim and Bogrot of our community who just finished high school. There was about like 14, 15 of them who are members of the Ashkenazi Shul in Eben Shmuel. And so most of them were there, and we all know each other. You know, when you live in small communities, everyone knows everybody, and we all kind of know what they're going to do, which is army service, pretty much entirely. And so you look at these kids, all of whom you've seen grow up, right? You remember them when they were young kids. You remember them messing around in the park or doing whatever and coming over for sukkah crawls and whatever. And then you see them, and you know probably the next time you may well be standing alongside these kids, many of them are going to be wearing a uniform, and the other ones are doing service in other ways. And you just take a moment and you say, I'm just so incredibly proud. It wasn't just about my daughter. My daughter happened to be one of them. She's doing shorter than me. But you're so proud of this group who have been raised not just by their parents, but raised by the village. When you have a yeshuva, everybody raises each other's kids to a certain measure or another. And you know that they've been given the education and the values to take that place, stand by that wall, and put in a lot of endeavor for the sake not just of themselves. In fact, arguably not for their sake at all. It's for our sake. And that you can see this and be so proud by that outlook. We're making those choices, even if you may well say it's an obligation, but it's a choice to have that attitude, notwithstanding the obligation. And I'm always bold by the attitudes of our younger people who have been through their youth movements and through their education and through the parenting and through the communities they've grown up in. They're able, on the precipice of making that big leap, and say, Hineni, I'm here, I'm ready, and I'm looking forward to serve the Jewish people. I'm serving Am Yisrael to defend Eretz Yisrael. And that shouldn't be taken, you know, and you're saying that, but it's just so, it's so beautiful. And these are the kids of our respective communities. They're the future defenders of our nation. They're future leaders of our nation. And they make us proud.
I want to add something to that. I agree with you 100%. I really feel that, like, this whole phrase, like, the Dor HaNitzachon, like, that's what they call this generation. Mm. It's not just a cliche or a sisma. It's true. Like, I stand in awe of these. I just stand in awe of this generation. And I also do want to say, because if we're talking about Aliyah, one of the things that I found as a teacher is to discover, first of all, there's a phenomenon of Aliyah, of excuse me, students who stay, which is a whole different story, but like, it's an incredible, like, the amount of Aliyah, which Ruby started at the beginning, is just unbelievable. But what I find most, not most impressive, but extremely impressive, is the amount of young men who are, as Ruby said, doing the army. They're either making Aliyah, or they're like
not making Aliyah, going back to army, college after.
Or not, and going back to the amount, like, it's like all of my students, it's their brothers, it's their friends, it's their peers. It's unbelievable. And I'm so bowled over, not only by the young men.
You should know that in the Hesder Yeshivot now, in the men's programs, I mean, it's not uncommon for a third to a half of them to joining Hesder, which is one in my day, I can tell you that.
What I want to say, it's a whole different landscape in terms of the Aliyah of the Noir, of the youth. But I have to say, to me, Ruby, the parents of those children, that is something that I have so much, I don't even know what the word is, like, I can't tell you how much admiration. They don't have to send their kids to the army. To allow their children to go to the army.
I'm making a face. Some are very supportive. Some are less supportive. When the kids make the decision.
Doesn't matter. It's hard enough to have children in the army when you've made Aliyah and you've thrown yourself into this and you signed up for this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To have your children go to the army, especially now, and you support your kid. I cannot.
I will amplify what you're saying because many parents, when their kids are in, won't leave the country.
I take off my hat to those parents.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. It's
not simple at all.
If we have listeners who are like live in Chutz La'aretz and your children are Chayalim Bodedim and they're joining the army, I cannot tell you how much admiration I have for that phenomenon. It's just unbelievable to me.
Okay, so after the love fest for our children, I want to sort of switch gears a little bit, and I think it would make sense for each of us to mention, I would say, a complication or a challenge that you see in the religious Zionist Aliyah. I think I'm going to go first. Molly, I'm going to disagree with what you said at the outset. We all live in yeshuvim. I live in a religious yeshuv. I find it a little bit bubbly. More than a little bit bubbly. Like, I live in a religious Zionist bubble. Now, life is great. It's a Gan Eden. I mean, you know, there's nothing like Shabbat afternoon and the kids are playing in the park and there's no cars in the street. But I can't pretend to myself that I'm connected to Am Yisrael, that I'm, as you said, a bridge to anything, most of us. I actually think what you mentioned about Rav Tamir is a response to a phenomenon, you know, an interesting phenomenon from the Hitnatkut, from the leaving Gaza, that suddenly we realized that we went to build all these yeshuvim and the country, you know, continued without us. You know, and there's a lot to be said for that, and many different kinds of Kav Yeshivot and not Kav Yeshivot are in Tel Aviv, ad kidei kach, to the point that now the secular people don't want, you know, religious people coming in and influencing their neighbors, but we'll leave that alone. Us three, me, like, I live in a bubble, and I like, it's comfortable for me and nice for me But I often wonder, you know, is there a selfishness to it? I'm not moving anytime soon. If my kids are listening, we're not going anywhere. You know, so, and I sometimes have the opportunity, as Johnny does, to officiate at weddings for Tzohar, and I kind of try to do my part in that. But in my work life, I work in a religious college. In my home life, I live in a religious world. I don't really interact with greater Israel in my life. And now, so many of my neighbors and colleagues, of course, they do in their work lives. I don't think they see it in that way. You know what I'm saying? I don't think they see work as a place where they really, really interact on a social level with their coworkers and affect them. And I think that bubbleness, it comes at a price in a way. And I'm not so sure that the choice is great and I really like it and I would do it again, but I think it's important to be aware of it and to understand it.
Can I push
it
back though?
Push away?
Yeah. Okay, this is how I want to push back. I think it's the same as I once read this analogy where they asked a feminist, was Anna Quinlan, how she felt about having gone to an all-girls school as opposed to a co-ed school. So she said it's kind of like when you learn how to swim and you hold on to the edge of the diving of the pool and you just kick with a kickboard for a really long time. And then when they let you swim, so like you might have to learn a little bit how to, you know, use the arm motions, but you are one heck of a kicker. And that's how I see raising our children in these bubbles, because I don't agree with you. That's exactly how I started. I think that for two things. First of all, I think what's happening is that we're raising our kids in these quote unquote bubbles, but then they leave the bubbles. And I think they all say to us, oh, you're raised just in a bubble, you know, like certainly in the gush. Oh, we were in the bubble of the gush and now we understand the real world. But I'm going to go back to my initial point.
So that's good, by the way. I keyed into something your kids say to you.
Yeah, of course they do. It's a very gush tofa'a. Like, you know, Israel is much bigger than what happened to the Gush, and the Gush is dwarfed by what happened to the left of the country. But again, I still think, like, I don't agree with you. I'm going to push back about what you said about the work. Because again, and maybe it's older generation, younger generation, this came from my son, this Edut, what he said. And again, we know that it's true, because you always know something's true when it gets pushback, right? When people, when you know, the cultural elites are concerned that the Dati Leumi are invading every area of society, right? And we see it, the head of the latest head of, you know, Roman Goffman is, I think he's Dati. Is he not Dati? I think he might be. Zini is Dati. Right, we're getting more and more soldier generals who are Dati. You watch the news. There's just a kippot everywhere. Do you know what I'm saying? And it's starting to make the cultural secular establishment, they're threatened by it. So what that tells me is if you're threatened by something, something's happening. It is happening.
Again, I'm saying about our choices, so, Molly. I'm talking about our lives.
So I'm going to go back and I'm saying, to me, I think it's like, again, send your kids the same way I believe. Send your daughters to an all-girls school. I think it's better. Put them in the hothouse and then send them out into the real world, because you will have empowered them in the hothouse. They can grow. It's like stay shun a bit. I can think of a million analogies for this, right? Like stay in that hothouse, build yourself, which in a way that you can do in the hothouse, and then you're going to have the power to go out and influence the world, which I do think is...
Okay, wait, time out. You raise your children. Your children are older now. Are you going to retire in Alunshvut?
Again, I made Aliyah. That was, for me, that was enough of a stretch. Huh. Do you understand that at my shabbos table, I can't speak English anymore?
What's that?
Do you know what I'm saying? At my shabbos table, I can't speak English anymore. My own shabbos table has been hijacked. Because thank God,
I have.
Okay, well, that's what I have. I have two in-laws who are completely Israeli, uh-huh. and for their comfort, there's a family decision that we speak Hebrew. So like my shabbos table has been hijacked, and as a friend of mine said to me, but that's successful Aliyah, right? So it's like everybody where they need to do it, but like it's a big deal. It's a big deal. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like I need to ramp the chili.
I want to turn to Rav Johnny. Yavo Ashli Shivi Achriya Benehem. Where do you feel on the bubble?
This is a topic we've mentioned before. I acknowledge that can happen and it's a phenomenon. So I say to myself, and I have mixed feelings. So one day a week, I live in a semi-bubble of sorts. But 6 days a week, I'm across the country. I'm every. If I told you the amount of places I visit on any given week, you'd kind of say, what are you doing? Like, are you a taxi driver?
I just think that. And I do think that.
Right, right. I spend, Yom Kippur and the secular kibbutz. I visit lots of places. I reach out to, and Baruch Hashem have relationships with a diverse set of friends, family, clients. And so I allow Shabbat to anchor myself, but I go out and I try and do, and I try and be both that voice and if that listener as well, because remember, our job isn't just to speak out, but it's to listen from, to hear people, and to learn from people. Actually, we've only started re-recording. We've paused it recently, but the secular kibbutz that I visit, Yom Kippur, I was giving a monthly shiur there for much of this year. Going there, spending time with people, creating relationships, and that's just one of many things. So when we talk about where you live,
Johnny, I kind of feel like you proved my point, because now I'm like, I feel doubly guilty that I don't do any of those things, and I marry people like a couple times a year.
And of course I do saw weddings as well. Where I do on the day that I don't drive, okay, fine. But our job is to understand the people of Israel, to contribute to the people of Israel, to serve in whichever way. We talked about different ways that people serve. I certainly feel the need to serve our people as best I can with the skill set and availability that I have. So even if there is a certain pang of guilt for Shabbat, basically, it's significantly counterweighed by the other endeavors and the other kind of efforts to try and do outreach and to try and, again, pay attention to and listen to the wider conversation. Of course, a person can be blinkered, and even if they are traveling, still only listen to the same types of podcasts from the same types of people, right? And only talk to the same kinds of people. Then one should broaden their repertoire. And I do think that the religious Zionist community at times can be somewhat blinkered. But in our essence, in terms of our ultimate call, in terms of our ultimate mission, it is not to be self-serving. It is to be other-serving. It's a certain sense of servant leadership, to be leaders while also trying to serve the wider Jewish nation, both here in Israel and beyond. And I try and do that myself, but many of the people I know, both where I live and elsewhere, do that as well. And it's exemplary.
I want to add one more thing, Ruby, because because you started with talking about Aliyah. I think it's so important to give people the sort of like space to be like, you make Aliyah to whatever the heck community, you're going to be able to be comfortable and happy. Mm-hmm. And so like, it's very nice for that and I respect what you're both saying about the larger Israeli society. But you know what? If you're going to feel comfortable making Aliyah to a very Anglo society where you're, because it's going to be a softer, and I don't mean soft in a derogatory sense, I mean in a healthy sense, it's going to work for you, then you do that. Meaning, I really think it's important to say that, like, we're talking very high ideals here, and I just want to make the space for, like, you know what, Aliyah's hard. You know, we don't need to go down that sort of road, but you said, like, bring up the challenges. It's hard enough to be an immigrant. Right? Being an immigrant is always, always, always going to be challenging. And the most successful way to do it, as I think I've mentioned in a previous podcast, but it doesn't matter, I'll just say it very briefly, is to have positive feelings both about your home country and positive feelings about the country you're going to. If you have negative feelings about your home country, or you have negative feelings about the country you're in, it's going to be messy. So if the way that you can have positive feelings with the country that you're in is to bring with you the positive feelings of the country from which you immigrated, and to live among people like that, and to a place that will retain that culture, because that's going to be how you're going to be able to positively integrate, then do that. And I want to make space for that. I really, yeah, really do.
Okay, I totally agree with you about that space. But it's not a yes or no, obviously. It's not a binary choice. And right. I think it's also, even in... even in the communities in which we choose to live, even if your person says, I got to live in Renana, I'm from South Africa, I got to go to Netanya, I'm from wherever, because those are my peeps. We still make choices about to what degree we want to integrate ourselves. And those choices, Molly, I was thinking about the story you told about your kids. they're directly impacting upon our kids' Correct. Integration as well. So I don't want to, you kind of have to leave that on the table as well and say, you know, everything, for an Olé, I'm sorry, I totally agree with Molly, everything about being an immigrant is uncomfortable. Everything. You know, it's just it's a change and there's pain involved. But then you have to decide, like you said, if you're doing it for your kids and you're doing it to bring them the most meaningful experience, so then you have to decide at what level, and it's really a hard decision, how alienated am I willing to feel so that my children will not experience that to some, you know, to some lesser
degree.
And also,
how am I going to acculturate my children so that my children won't feel that way? I think that's a really important thing.
But I'm saying
that
you have to, I accept your point about soft landings, but it has to be counterbalanced with the other
point. Well taken, because I think one of the, you know, we don't have time to go into this issue, but, you know, issues of children and having problems acculturating, I think one of the factors is how much did you set them up to acculturate successfully? Like, how much did you set them up to feel Israeli, and how much did you not do that for all kinds of reasons? And I think you're right. I personally do think that that's an important value. You need to do what you need to do for yourself. Think about the fact that your children need to feel part of the world that they are living in. I think that's a very good point.
John, do you want to add something before we wrap it up?
I mean, this is a topic we've spoken about before, but it certainly deserves repeating.
I think we're going to repeat ourselves sometimes. You know, like, we're a niche podcast, where people might hit topics more than once.
But actually, something I didn't mention to you when we were preparing. At 8 o'clock this morning, I had a session with a couple who are very much making plans to make Aliyah, and they're considering where to move, but not just where to, but also how to. They're leaving a great community outside of Israel where things are strong, things are arguably successful. For various reasons, they feel that Aliyah is definitely the right thing for them to do. They're questioning just a little bit as to where and a little bit as to when. And we had a very candid conversation. I was proud about the fact that I didn't sugarcoat some of the challenges. And I told them they had to ask themselves, what are they prepared to go through in order to make sure the acculturation of their children is successful? That's a fair point. But anybody, as you say, considering Aliyah, younger people with families, prepared to make that seismic change, and it's multi-leveled and multi-layered. You know, the list of things you're going to have to wrestle with and adapt to is so long. And it'll be a process, and it's really almost a lifetime process. You know, I made Aliyah 14 years ago. There's still things just trying to figure out. I'd like to think the majority of things we're down pat on.
I'm still trying to figure out how to pronounce the letter Resh. I haven't gotten that.
it's so admirable, and especially when the summer comes, seeing people making that choice, coming here, and beginning a journey, which will take many years. And I'd like to think that if anybody's considering that who are listening to us and they'd like to follow up with one of us or all of us, feel free to write to us. I think we've been very candid about both the strengths and weaknesses of our communities, but also incredibly proud of the heartbeat, which is the Jewish nation, and the heartbeat, which is also the religious Zionist communities, which we're so proud of.
I would reiterate that. I think with all the terrible things we've been through the past 3 years, I feel blessed to have been part of this, part of Jewish history, part of, you know, having to suffer through this in a real way, having to have it experience this, having to send our children to this. I cannot imagine having to have sat on the sidelines in such an important, you know, place and time. And that means that it's challenging. That means that it's difficult. But I like how you described it. It's just a never-ending journey. And as long as you're on the path and as long as you're willing to continue the journey, you know, that willingness and readiness to me is the most important element for success. Molly, you want to wrap it up?
You had asked in the beginning if we were going to do recommendations this week, and I was like, I totally forgot my recommendation, but I just remembered it.
Oh, go ahead.
So maybe that's a
recommendations.
Let's do recommendations because this fits. That's what reminds me was what Johnny said. I have a friend who's. It's not a recommendation of a specific thing. It's just a recommendation of become aware of a certain phenomenon. A friend, and this is not my only friend who's done this, but there's a track for people who have made Aliyah later, who didn't do the army, to join the army, right? To do these like fast track. Sure, I don't even know how to describe it, but a friend, more than one friend's husband has done this, but a good friend of mine's husband just did it, and she sent a video of like this group, and it's like a motley crew of like, you know, anybody from 40 to 75, and they did like real, it wasn't, this isn't just like, you know, like they pretended to do Tehran, they did like mamash real, like they learned how to be fighters, they learned how to be soldiers, in order to give to the community and to give to the country and to protect their communities. That's why I said community, because a lot of them are going to go back and be part of their Kitok Kananut to protect their own communities. And I found it so moving and so inspiring. So my recommendation is like in a time where like there's so much like tension around this issue of army and, you know, like pilug in the am, you know, arguments in the country. It was so inspiring. It's like, just look up these people. I don't even know how you would find them, but just look up these like programs and just watch the videos of like these like, you know, 50-year-olds who have decided to sacrifice of their time and their comfort and their families, you know, for however long it is, in order to give back to Am Yisrael. And it's like, just, it's so inspiring. It will restore your, when you're feeling down, it will restore your faith in the Jewish people and in the Zionist enterprise. That's my recommendation.
Johnny, what do you got?
So the day after we last recorded, I went to Sderot because there was a book launch there. Actually, there's a resilience center, Merkaz Chosen in Sderot, and they had not just hosted this event, that actually partially funded the publication of a wonderful book that was just published by Magid, titled Hitchadshut HaNefesh Tmicha Post-Traumatit Mimkorot Chasidut, to translate Renewing the Soul, Post-Traumatic Growth from Hasidic Sources by Roi Horen. And it was an unbelievable evening of talk and music. Rav Tamir came, he knows Roi very well. And this book, which I'm working through slowly, not because I can't read it quicker, but because I don't want to. It is unbelievable. It talks about the individual and national post-traumatic growth that we've seen in recent years, referencing survivors of October 7th and the war that followed, while drawing from Hasidic sources, which give inspiration to those people to be able to find those growth moments despite the trauma they've gone through. So the evening was amazing. The center then, Sderot, is amazing. The book, I think, is unbelievable. And if it's something you're interested in, it's in Hebrew. I hope it gets translated for those who may struggle. But it's a fabulous book. And it just brings together Torah, wisdom, the life experience, the difficulty, but with a message of hope and a message of light.
Okay. I will conclude with first a moment of shameless self-promotion. By a quirk of the schedule, I'm actually giving a shiur at the Herzl College Meiyun B'Tanach this year, which I'm quite excited about. I've never done it before. I will be speaking about, on Sunday, July 12th, David HaMelech, the Amidah, and the Politics of Jewish Redemption. Okay, which if you're wondering what those things have to do with one another, you'll have to come to the shiur or maybe watch it online afterwards. I don't know, but I'm excited about it. I'm a little nervous, to be honest with you. It's a big ma'amad, so come support quietly. Okay, and the other thing I wanted to share is totally off topic, not religious, not Jewish. I got into Clarkson's Farm. Have you ever, do you know about this show?
Oh, I've heard about it. Yeah.
Oh, it's the best.
I should watch it.
Jerry Clarkson, if you know, he was like the brash guy on Top Gear. Johnny, do you know what Top Gear is? You're from Britain. Do you have any idea what Top Gear is?
Okay. Of course. Okay. Give me a break.
So he retired. He actually bought a farm to get a tax break, you know, because you can like inherit like in England. And then he decided he's going to work on the farm. I have to say it's a great show. It's just wonderful. A good diversion, totally clean. So if you're looking to waste time in a less meaningless kind of way, I happen to have so that's my recommendation for your summer viewing. It's on Amazon Prime, Clarkson Farm. All right, that's the end of our podcast. I want to thank Marvini Mali Brodsky and Rav Johnny Solomon. I want to thank all our listeners for the positive feedback we gave you this week. You gave us this week. I think we heard quite a bit and we appreciate it. We are happy, of course, if you have constructive criticism, gentle constructive criticism. But of course, we'd love your compliments as well. I think, Johnny, we're gonna, scheduling wise, We're going to take a month because it's the summer. Is that the schedule that we, just for our listeners to know?
I think that's what we kind of said.
Yeah. Right. It's the summer. So please God, the schedule is going to be once every other week. It's going to be RZ biweekly. Again, we really need a new name. But until that time, if you don't see us in your feed, enjoy your summer. And everyone should have an easy, meaningful fast. And b'ezras Hashem, we're not going to see each other before Tisha B'Av. Maybe this Tisha B'Av, the world events will bring the opportunity that we will have to pass yet another year. Bye, everybody.